About 766 years ago in London, there was a brilliant story of something that happens that, well, it's one of those tales that show that for all the differences between us living today and people living in the past, they sometimes would act in a way we would find remarkably familiar. So, the then Abbot of Westminster Abbey died. That great big church located down in Westminster next door to the King's Palace was an important place, and therefore the person running it was an important position. So who would replace him? Well, the records at the time say that, quote, Philip, the prior of said monastery, was now elected abbot thereof, unquote. And that makes sense. He had a position of responsibility within the abbey hierarchy. He was ideal. It's a bit of a promotion, really. But Philip had issues, and they were, quote, but when he heard of his election, he expressed great reluctance in giving his consent, through fear of that most oppressive decree by the Pope, compelling every elected prelate to go to Rome in person, for he was fat and heavy in body, unquote. Yeah, the rules were that if you got a high-ranking position within the church, you had to go to the Pope to get it confirmed. But big-boned Philip of Westminster, he really didn't want to go. Quote, for he preferred, and it would have been better for him to have done so, to remain at home in his former mode of life, rather than to expose himself to such peril for the sake of worldly dignity, unquote. I think many people would appreciate greatly Prior Philip of Westminster's inclinations here. I mean, he was clearly enjoying his life here in London. Why would he want to give it up to make an uncertain journey to Rome of all places? Please. However, poor Philip, quote, being however overcome by exhortations of the brethren and by his legitimate election by the whole community, he at length acceded to their wishes, on condition, however, that they would send some other persons to the court to obtain a confirmation of his election, unquote. Yep, portly Phil would agree to become the abbot, but only if one of the other monks would travel to the continent, make all the way down to Rome and ask the Pope to accept his appointment. If they want him so much, it's the least they can do. And so, that's exactly what happened. Quote, some of the more eminent of the brethren therefore set out for that purpose and pleaded the most urgent reasons and excuses for the non-attendance of the abbot-elect, unquote. Those brave monks then left Westminster, sailed down the Thames, sailed over to Europe, travelled all the way to Rome, and there pleaded, bargained, and negotiated with the cardinals of the Holy City to allow Abbot become Abbot of Westminster without being there in person. Of course, all of the arguments were simply window dressing in Rome, as in England at the time. The oil that greased wheels of any decision was cash. And apparently they handed over a large sum of cash to the Roman Curia to allow heavy-boned Philip become the Abbot of Westminster Abbey. Ah. Mission accomplished, the monks set off home. Only to be told on their way back, oh, sorry, Philip's just died. Someone else is now Abbot of Westminster. Could you go back and let the Pope know? Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that attempts to try to present the history of the city as a single grand narrative, a sweeping story that has been told in nearly 100 chapters so far. We have reached the year 1259 and are in the era of intense complexity, where the story I've just told is a nice illustration of people being motivated by a mixture of passion, or lethargy, or cash. And it's about the influence of those men who could best be described in Latin as via simplex, a simple man. The king had been reduced to a puppet. The nation has been run by a committee of 15 knights. Famine and ongoing diseases rampage through its subjects. There is a wave of paranoia sweeping the entire place about people being poisoned, and there was no one firmly in control of things. I cannot hope, nor do I pretend, to offer you a fully detailed and accurate description of the events that are to follow. Not if I want to try and tell this story in an entertaining manner, but I hope to be able to give you a decent overview as to the multiple complex debates and arguments raging about the city in this time period, the passions of those involved, and how this impacted upon the city going forward. Welcome then to Chapter 95 of The Story of London, Via Simplex. So, there's a lot going on this episode, politically, and it's time to offer an utterly not complete list of names of people who you will see appearing in this episode, just so we're all on the same page. You have Hugh Bigod, the brother of the Earl of Norfolk, who'd been chosen by the barons to be the Chief Justiciar of England, which effectively made him the front guy of the Committee of 15 Knights who were technically running England in the name of the King. You have the king himself, Henry III, now reduced to being no more than a rubber stamp, really. He'd been isolated politically and is doing his usual response when things are stressful for him, so he'd become seriously more religious and was basically living his I Am Edward the Confessor cosplay routine 24/7. You have his son, Prince Edward, known as Lord Edward, who had to go along with this and probably was stewing. You had the king's brother-in-law, Simon de Montfort, or Simon de Montfort, who was all up in that Council of 15. And while he was just one of many, he was becoming a vocal voice in the committee. You had the Earl of Gloucester, Richard de Clare, who was a huge powerhouse on the baron's side, and does seem to be one of the nobles many in London trusted and supported. And he'd fallen sick recently, but recovered, and the whispers were abounded that that had been poison. You also have the Bishop of London, Fulk, who was blowing very hot and cold on the idea of having the king obey the barons, and this was causing tensions between him and the new regime. And you got the king's brother, Richard, who's currently over in Germany, as he was chosen to be king there. These and others are all going to pop up in the episode to come. So how did 1259 work out for London? Well, it started, don't forget, with a terrible famine, which was leaving thousands dead across the nation and upon the streets of London. And food prices, as such, are skyrocketing. And it is only food relief from Europe sent from Germanic ports that are keeping large cities like London from becoming tombs. We know that John de Gisors became mayor this year, and that this year a parliament was held in Westminster, where the king rubber-stamped an edict that clarified and enhanced the edicts from the parliament in Oxford the year before, further reinforcing the powers of the Justiciar and the Committee of 15. And the records say that, quote, after a parliament held by the barons at Westminster, Hugh Bigod, the Justiciar, went to St. Saviour's, and having Roger de Turkably as his associate, held there all the pleas which pertained to the Justiciar's itinerant in the county of Surrey, unquote. So, the Justiciar of the land travelled to just south of the river, to Southwark, which technically did come under the jurisdiction of the county of Surrey, not the city, and there he dealt with some local cases. But during his time there, some men of Southwark and others from Surrey, quote, made complaint against the sheriffs and citizens of London that they unjustly took custom without the stone gate off the bridge, seeing that they ought to possess no such rights beyond the drawbridge gate, unquote. So yeah, Southwark is complaining about London, and in particular, where the jurisdictional boundaries of London on London Bridge ended. What's interesting is a response. Quote, the citizens, coming with their sheriffs who'd been summoned by the Justiciars, appeared at St. Saviour's before the Justiciars and bringing with them their charters, said they were not bound to plead there, nor would they plead without the walls of the city. But without formal plea, they were willing to acknowledge that it was quite lawful for the sheriffs of London to take custom without the gate aforesaid, and that too even as far as the Five Staples place there, seeing that the whole water of Thames pertains unto the city, and always did pertain thereto, and that too seaward as far as the New Weir, unquote. So, Justiciar turned up at St. Saviour's down in Southwark. He summoned the Londoners to answer this complaint. The Londoners' first response was simple. We don't need to make a plea or respond to anything in this stinking court. Remember, they had their charters, and the case hung on the old rights of London as codified by the charter given to the city by Henry I, which I covered in some detail in the second part of Chapter 61. London citizens could or should only deal with allegations against them in London, under their own legal system, according to that charter. But, as we've said, the clash between the Crown Justices and London Justices I've been covering as ongoing since Chapter 88. At the heart, however, was about where London's authority ended. The residents of Southwark said it was about halfway or two-thirds of the way up along the bridge. The residents of London said it had always been at the far end of the bridge. The bridge was London. The Justiciar agreed, saying that, quote, upon oath, that the sheriffs aforesaid might rightfully take custom there, for that, as far as the staples before mentioned, the whole pertains unto the city, and no one has any right upon the Thames, as far as the new weir, save and except the citizens of London, unquote. So here we see London had won, and for future reference, London Bridge was part of London Town. So hey, the new regime seems to back London up. But still, the issue is arising. London insisting that they alone should be responsible for the jurisdiction of law within the city, not any Crown authority. Even if, as we saw in Chapter 88, they'd conceded the issue some years previously. And the clashes with the justices appointed by Henry III now continued with Hugh Bigod, the baronial appointed Chief Justice. Because we read that, quote, after this, the Justiciar before mentioned came to the Guildhall of London, and there held pleas from day to day, observing no due procedure of justice, and that too against the laws of the city. This, however, the citizens persistently challenged, saying that no one except the sheriffs of London ought to hold proceedings in the city as to trespass there committed, unquote. Now, the impression I get here is that of London was trying it on with the new regime a little, trying to win arguments they had lost against the King's justices. And you know what? These arguments didn't work, and the complaints came, quote, to no purpose. Still, however, the citizens had judgment done upon all persons abiding in the city who had been convicted and had been cast in making false charge, unquote. So yeah, new regime who dis? The Baronial Committee of 15 was clearly letting London know that even if the King has become a rubber-stamping person, they still would exercise power in his name to the same extent. And indeed, soon after, those court cases went down, and no matter what the Londoners said, they were going to just carry on. The Justiciar decided to remind London just how powerful he could be. Quote, at the same time also, the Justiciar summoned before himself and before the Earl of Gloucester all the bakers of the city who could be found, together with their loaves. And so, by some few citizens summoned before them, judgment was given in reference to their bread. Those whose bread did not weigh according to the assay of the city, not being placed in the pillory as they used to be, but at the will of the Justiciar and the Earl aforesaid, exalted in the tumbril, against the ancient usage of the city and of all the realm, unquote. So this is actually a heck of a story. This suggests that the standard punishment for bakers who sold underweight bread was, as we've seen, a fine, as we saw in previous episodes, but it could also be the use of the pillory. To be placed somewhere where your crime was proclaimed and you could be mocked for what you did, that's a pretty severe social punishment. But here, it seems that the Earl of Gloucester and the Justiciar decided to make big examples of these guys. They were exalted in the tumbril, which suggests a punishment a tad more severe. Now, first of all, one has to understand that a tumbril could also be used at the time to suggest a ducking stool, which meant their punishment was that they were dunked under the water of the River Thames. But I'll be honest, it's probably not that, and I don't see any historians back that particular reading. The tumbril probably meant an actual tumbril, a two-wheeled cart led by an ox. And this whole story suggests that rather than be publicly named and shamed and placed in the pillory on Westcheap, the bakers who were serving low measures of wheat were paraded through the streets to be mocked by everyone. Centuries later, tumbrils would drag the nobility of France to La Guillotine to face their deaths at the roar of baying crowds. But here we are, half a millennium before that, and London is so far ahead of the French. I'm wondering how embarrassment such a punishment would feel to experience. To be paraded around in front of your neighbours, accused of petty crimes like this in public, to the mockery of all. Given the overall weakness of the judicial system at the time, it does sound like a punishment designed to make you compliant to such rules and regulations pretty fast. Now, London was not just to witness the ongoing attempts by the new regime to gain legitimacy and to stomp their authority, but also their worry that as they tried to do this, the king and his allies would try to undo what they have done. And indeed, this became a matter unto itself, as word came to England that Richard, former Earl of Cornwall, younger brother of the king, and now King of the Germans, wished to, quote, come to England to visit his relatives and friends and his native land and look after his property, unquote. This decision caused intense worry within the new regime. Quote, for they suspected that on his coming he would vent his anger and indignation on the barons, accusing them now of persecuting and showing their hatred to his brother, King Henry, as they formerly did to his father, unquote. Added to that, there was an utter panic towards the Lusignan in-laws of the king, and the powers that be were worried that Richard would try and bring them back in. They were really worried that he would, quote, either bring them back with him by stealth, or would at some future time effect a reconciliation and treacherously extort them to return to England to trample it underfoot, unquote. And even if he wasn't going to bring back the Lusignans, quote, they likewise feared he would impede and oppose their salutary resolutions for the arrangement of the affairs of the kingdom, and that after balking them in their designs, he would re-establish the old order of things and punish them, the barons, one after another, and would finally disinherit them, unquote. I mentioned last episode how an overall air of paranoia and uncertainty was sweeping England in the face of the ongoing famines and epidemics and political changes, and this is clearly part of it. The ruling council of England agreed the king's brother could come visit, of course, and it's worth remembering that food convoys from him had, according to Matthew Paris, been the only thing that prevented the land from being even more crippled by starvation the year before. But the atmosphere of his arrival was tense, fearful. The never-ending, near-hysterical fear of civil war just hung in the air. You want proof? Well, the accounts say that after meeting his brother on the coast, quote, the two kings and their queens, accompanied by a great many of the nobles of England, reached the city of London, which had been properly cleared of filth and richly decorated for the arrival of great princes. And they were met on their approach by a large number of citizens, uttering shouts of welcome. The city, indeed, was so full of people that the pavements of the streets were entirely covered by the crowds assembled. And as Richard's Uterine brothers were not in his train, as was suspected and threatened, they gave their vent to their joy with still greater eagerness, unquote. Oh, the relief. London, scrubbed up London to see the visit of the King of Germany, aka the brother of the King of England, is packed. People turned up because they were genuinely believing that the Lusignans were going to show up. And that was it. It was going to kick off. But they were not present. Phew. Still, London could only wonder what else was going on with the body politic. As later that year, you got the king performing his ritual of summoning the citizens to St. Paul's Cross, there to get them to swear their traditional allegiance to him as he was leaving to travel to France. But more on that later. Ultimately, 1259 was a year of great paranoia, of the fear of the campaign of poisoning that was going on behind the scenes and was apparently continuing. And we read about March that year, quote, Walter Scutinini, the special and chief advisor and seneschal of the Earl of Gloucester, was taken prisoner at London on suspicion of having administered poison to the said Earl, unquote. But it wasn't just suspected high-profile political prisoners who were being arrested under suspicion of being these mythical poisoners. London could find scapegoats within the city to join this conspiracy theory. Because there was a Jewish resident of London who, quote, report stated that it was in his house that the poisonous liquor was made which had brought danger and death to so many of the nobles of England, and that it is said that he willingly allowed the transaction to be carried on, unquote. So we've got this Jewish pharmacist, by the sounds of things, who seems to be blamed for having made these liquids that were being used as poisons. Luckily for him, he managed to escape any punishments as, quote, fearing that he was in danger of being condemned for some crime, fled to the font for safety and protection, unquote. So yeah, he became a Christian and effectively was forgiven of previous sins, such as being a Jew, when he became a Christian. And in the language of the anti-Semitic records of the time, this man, quote, being purified by the wholesome process of baptism in the company of two others, he was snatched from the ranks of the devil and saved from the punishment due to a most base crime formerly perpetuated by him, unquote. Yet despite all this, the year was going to be remembered for one thing above all others. Quote, an unexpected pestilence and mortality fell upon mankind, unquote. While England does seem to have suffered waves of famine and pestilence, this comes across as some unknown and short-lived epidemic, if not a pandemic of some type, because it's not just limited to England. The records refer to, quote, the great numbers that died in other places. In Paris alone, more than 1,000 human beings were consigned to the tomb, unquote. So this epidemic, which may have been something new impacting upon the weakened immune systems of the hungry residents of England, or it could have been the same thing that had been hitting England over the last few years, hit London again in a brutal wave. And, quote, as the two-handed sword of death, which spares no one, strikes sometimes one and sometimes the other, and hurries from the world the rich and the poor alike, so Fulk, Bishop of London, died during that deadly pestilence. That prelate was a man of noble disposition and high family, and had he not, some little while previously, wavered in giving his support to the general arrangements of the kingdom, he would have been considered the anchor of stability and the buckler of defence to the whole kingdom. Finally, he was buried with due solemnity on St. Urban's Day at St. Paul's Church at London, unquote. So, with the death of Bishop Fulk, a former King's Chancellor called Henry Widdam becomes Bishop of London, and the city tried to plough through another wave of death. But as 1259 crawled into 1260, King Henry sailed to France, and when he got there, he made a slow, incredibly slow procession to see his counterpart, the King of France. Henry was in his full I am Edward the Confessor mode, and he stopped at seemingly every church along the way, there to celebrate Mass and to show his dour piety to all. And he was in France because the barons had ordered him to make peace with France, something that was to be called the Treaty of Paris. And the Treaty of Paris was to represent, in many ways, the end of the great Plantagenet Empire once and for all. Henry was compelled to do liege homage to Louis, renouncing once and all his claims to empire and acknowledging that he held his remaining continental possessions down in Gascony as a peer of the realm of France rather than as a king in his own right. And this caused division in the ruling council back in England. The king had been sent to surrender, and not everyone agreed with him, A, being told to do it, and B, him doing it. And two men noticeably objected, Simon de Montfort and Edward, the eldest son of the king. Both men did not want this to happen, and a serious row now began in the king's absence. We know, quote, it had been arranged by Sir Edward, the king's son, and the Earl of Gloucester, who were then at variance, that they should hold a general parliament at Westminster 3 weeks after Easter Day. And it was also proposed that they, and many other earls, and barons, and knights, should, with their horses and arms, take up their abode within the city. Unquote. At variance. Ominous words. Prince Edward and the Duke of Gloucester were at odds. The men with horses and armour and swords were picking sides, and they wanted to stay within the walls of London. It was obvious that if fighting started, quote, that very great loss and peril might have been occurred, therefore, to the citizens and the city, unquote. So the powers that be basically went into panic mode. And as a neutral, quote, Sir Richard, King of the Romans, came to Westminster in Easter week and summoning the mayor and certain discreet men of the city in presence of himself and the chief justicar and Sir Philip Bassett, held conference with them as to avoiding this peril, unquote. So how do we stop this fight starting in the streets of the city? The solution was that the king's son and the Earl of Gloucester, quote, nor anyone else as to whom any suspicion might be entertained, should be harboured within the walls of the city, which was accordingly done. It was also provided that all persons of 15 years and upwards, each to the best of his ability, should be well provided with arms, and that all the city gates should be closed at night and watched by armed men, and should not be opened in the daytime, with the exception of Bridgegate, Ludgate, and Alegate, which were also to be well fortified with armed men. Unquote. London went into lockdown mode as around it powerful factions seized and argued. So, effectively, the citizens of London are now being given weapons and told, yep, just defend the city, don't let these other guys in, they're not allowed in, they're going to solve their arguments over in Westminster. And it's at this point, his business done in France, King Henry III decided to return to London, quote, and took up his abode in the hostel of the Bishop of London, unquote. Now, the king was in London and he saw division and he saw a chance to exploit that division and he decided that, quote, the Earl of Gloucester and many others, at his will, to be harboured within the city, the gates, in the meantime, being well fortified with armed men by day and by night. Sir Edward, however, and the Earl of Leicester and their followers were lodged without the city, both at the Hospital of Jerusalem and in other houses which lay between the city and Westminster, unquote. The dissension between the barons gave the king an opening. He suddenly had agency in the situation. The city was marginally his now, and he was the man keeping both sides apart, but he saw an advantage and he saw how to use it. Quote, the king also commanded that all persons of age of 12 years and upwards should make oath before their aldermen in every ward that they would be faithful unto him so long as he should live and after his death to his heir, which was accordingly done, unquote. The king then reinforced the rulings that the gates are shut up at night and basically, in order to stop a fight between the differing members of the baronial forces taking place in London, the baronial forces had ordered London to go on lockdown mode, gave everybody weapons, and this huge body of civilians acted as a peacekeeping force. The king turned up, is now living in London, and is now using that to his advantage. London is now seemingly the king's bastion. And this saw tensions suddenly emerge towards Londoners from elsewhere. At the Fair of Northampton, a fight broke out, quote, between the Londoners and the men of Northampton. Certain persons of Northampton were wounded, and one of them afterwards died, unquote. Now the records say that, quote, the bailiffs, however, of that town, who were always envious of the Londoners, seized four men of London, imputing the death to them, and after imprisoning them, seized all their goods, as well as those of other Londoners. Upon hearing this, the mayor and citizens obtained royal letters directing them to deliver up such persons to the mayor or his messengers bearing such letters, that they might take their trial before the king, as they ought to, according to the laws of the city. The said bailiffs, however, would not let them go, either for that writ or for another, unquote. This argument between Northampton and London would rumble on for a while. And away from these events, politics was taking a life of its own. By the end of 1260 and the start of 1261, Hugh Bigod resigned his post as justicar. By all accounts, he was in disagreement with the factions within the Committee of the 15. The new regime was fragmenting, and Henry decided to just press the advantage hard. The king sought to appoint Philip Basset to the now vacant position of Chief Justicar, and he broke with the provisions of the parliaments, which had said he couldn't appoint anybody like that without first asking their assent. The barons retaliated by removing the king's sheriffs and appointing, quote, wardens of the counties, unquote, in their stead. And then, in London, Henry unleashed his most powerful weapon. He unleashed the Pope. In June 1261, Henry produced a bull of Alexander IV, annulling the provisions of Oxford and freeing him from his obligations and oaths. As a previous pope had lifted his father from the demands of the Magna Carta, so now the same was happening here, and tensions ratcheted up a lot. This was a throwdown. This could be the trigger of a civil war. But with Richard de Clare, the Earl of Gloucester, and the former Justicar Hubie God now switching to the king's side, the baronial opposition blinked first and backed down. Simon de Montfort fled to France, and King Henry had won. And somehow he was in charge again. 1261 and 1262 are confusing, chaotic years. Talks continue between the two sides. Politics was all back and forth and around and round. But all we need to know, and I am simplifying the story here drastically, but we'll come back to it, is that eventually Simon de Montfort, the Earl of Leicester, ended up taking to the field and raising a capital army against that of his brother-in-law, the king. And that London was to be part of this, a crucial part of this, a large part of his army. And to get there, we have to understand and now mention one man, Thomas FitzThomas, four-time mayor of London. He was on paper an ideal choice to become the new mayor of London. He was an Eschewin, born the son of a rich man. He was said to be a draper. So his family's fortunes, based on what we know at the time, seem to have been focused on the import and export of Flemish cloth, which, as I covered back in chapter 90, had come to dominate the English market. So in principle, this would make Thomas FitzThomas the kind of mayor who would support London's vested interests, the aldermen, the oligarchs, the merchants, etc., etc. Business as usual. And yet, FitzThomas was not like other mayors. He seems to have been far more in the mould of FitzOsbert, Longbeard, that firebrand troublemaker and whose campaign against corruption and subsequent deaths had so troubled the later years of the reign of the first ever mayor of the city, and whose story we told in chapter 79. FitzThomas appealed to the general working population of London, not the vested interests and merchants and traditional leaders of this community. From the aldermen, the criticism of this new mayor was strong. Quote, be it here remarked that this mayor, during the time of his mayoralty, had so pampered the city populace that, styling themselves the commons of the city, they had obtained the first voice in the city, unquote. With everything going on across England and the city, the overlooked people of London finally seemed to have a champion. He seemed to bypass the traditional way of doing things, of consulting only with his fellow aldermen. The accounts of his critics actually say, quote, for the mayor, in doing all he had to do, acted and determined through them, and would say to them, is it your will, so it shall be? And then if they answered, yeah, yeah, so it was done, unquote. And to the indignation of those richer elements of the city, quote, on the other hand, the aldermen or chief citizens were little or not at all consulted on such matters, but were in fact just as though they had not existed, unquote. So considering this is the complaint against him, and this account is trying to paint him in a bad light, I think as a Londoner, I can honestly say, he sounds great, doesn't he? A proper mayor who listened to his people. Oh, we like this FitzThomas. He sounds fantastic. And as such, he made a huge impact upon the population. To quote his critics, quote, through this, that same populace became so elated and inflated with pride that during the commotions in the realm, they formed themselves into covens and leagued themselves together by oath, by the hundred or by the thousand, under a sort of colour of keeping the peace, unquote. So, this is ironic. The order by the Justicars that the citizens of London and should arm themselves to protect the city, which was then reinforced by the king, were now manifesting itself as leagues of hundreds of citizens organising themselves to keep the peace. I'm just going to mention in passing, all the way back in book one of the story in chapter 17, the Peace Guild of 10th century London, to remind you of how dangerous such a thing could be. And it was dangerous, these mobs. They were violent and they were a vigilante force now driven to politics. And FitzThomas wasn't just provoking those passions of the people. Some of his reforms were economic. Quote, "The mayor too had all the populace of the city summoned, telling them that the men of each craft must make such provisions as should be to their own advantage, and he himself would have the same proclaimed throughout the city and strictly observed," unquote. What's he doing? Well, some of the manufacturing crafts of London, such as the cordwainers, the girdlers, the skinners, the ironmongers, these were given the opportunity to seize the passions of the new mayor, to have their internal rules and ordinances ratified by the mayor, or in short, to form adulterine trade guilds and to be granted protections. What would that do? Well, according to the critics, quote, "Accordingly, after this, from day to day, individuals of every craft of themselves made new statutes and provisions, or rather, what might be styled abominations, and that solely for their own advantage and to the intolerable loss of all the merchants coming to London and visiting the fairs of England, and the exceeding injury of all the persons in the realm," unquote. The complaints here are coming from merchants who were dominated by foreigners, don't forget. FitzThomas was allowing Londoners gain a semblance of economic power, of standing up to the domination of the fairs and the merchant interests. And all of these reforms and so much more was to come out of this new mayor's alliance with the new champion of the baronial forces, Simon de Montfort. And I will go into more detail about this next episode, because theirs was a covenant made in blood. And it saw London go from passive witnesses endlessly coping with the pressures of the kingdom to active participants in the battles to come, even if that was going to cost the city deeply. But for the last 10 chapters of the story of London, I've documented the long, seemingly endless issues King Henry III had caused in the city, and how around him the nation had changed, and how London's aldermen and leaders had tried to cope with these things. And really, even though he's going to be alive for a bit more, this is the last moment Henry III had any agency in the story of London. Henry III has been called many things. He was not a good king. To be frank, when you balance all together, the last three kings of England had not been very good. And it's true, over his long reign, he did display way more incompetence than many a king we've mentioned previously. But at least he was present. He never quite reached the utter disaster level uselessness of his uncle, Richard I. And well, I dedicate a whole chapter as to why I dislike that man. But for all the condemnations of him, the most damning, I suppose, came after his death. The writer, Dante, when composing his sequel to Inferno, Purgatory, here he described King Henry as waiting to enter heaven in Purgatory. Quote, "See the king who led a simple life," unquote, says the narrator, viewing him sadly. For many, Dante's simple life was no compliment. For many, Dante was describing the true sin of Henry III, via simpler, a simple man. A simple man in a complex world who was unable to cope with its vicissitudes. And there's no sin in that. He could have been like Philip of Westminster and tried to avoid it. But alas, he was king. And the devils and demons and calamity of the times, therefore, be laid at his feet. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with another episode of The Story of London. Story of London only exists due to contributions and donations given to it by its listeners. If you have enjoyed this episode and you can and feel so inclined, please go check out our Buy Me a Coffee page and maybe give a small donation just to help us to cover the fees for another month. We're not doing this to get rich. Okay, thanks a million. See you next week. Bye.